Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for September 10th, 2010. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, estimating the future global warming impact of current infrastructure, a 2010 reality check on progress in biodiversity conservation, and the role of the tau protein in the pathology of Alzheimer's disease. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
A new paper in Science attempts to quantify the commitment to future global warming represented by existing CO2-emitting devices and infrastructure, with some sobering implications regarding the amount of work ahead to transition to carbon-free energy sources. Here with more on the story is Science's Sophia Kai.
Human activity currently pumps 30 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere each year, and, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has contributed to warming the world 0.7 degrees Celsius or more in the last 100 years. But, notes Stephen Davis of the Carnegie Institution of Washington in Stanford, California, even if economic growth stopped today, the world would keep on warming for some time.
In general, the problem of climate change has tremendous inertia, and some of that inertia relates to the natural carbon cycle. But there's also inertia in the man-made infrastructure that is emitting CO2 and other greenhouse gases.
Davis is the lead author of a new paper that investigates this current commitment to future carbon emissions and global warming.
So we tried to quantify that infrastructural inertia by asking a hypothetical question, and that is, what if we never built another CO2-emitting device, but only the ones already in existence lived out their normal expected lifetimes?
To do that, Davis and his colleagues assembled data on the greenhouse gas output and expected lifetimes of power plants and motor vehicles worldwide, as well as estimates on emissions from other sectors published by the International Energy Agency. They used those data sets to project how much CO2 would be added to the atmosphere over the next 50 to 100 years as that existing infrastructure served out its expected lifetime. And they used the University of Victoria's Earth System Climate Model to infer what those CO2 levels meant for global mean temperatures. Their findings?
We were actually a little surprised that the existing infrastructure really allows us to stabilize at less than 430 parts per million, and that warming would only be somewhere around 1.2 or 1.3 degrees.
That is, temperatures would stabilize at 1.3 degrees above pre-industrial levels if no new CO2-emitting devices were built or new cars put on the road. That's well below the internationally discussed policy benchmark that calls for limiting CO2 emissions to less than 450 parts per million and attempting to hold warming to less than 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. The finding of this hypothetical scenario, says Davis, puts the focus firmly on the future and also hints at the magnitude of the challenge ahead.
What the upshot of our analysis is suggesting is that the devices whose emissions will cause the worst impacts from climate change really have yet to be built. And so, you know, obviously that's really great news, but it doesn't mean that, you know, we can just all wipe our hands and go home, because our hypothetical scenarios are really far from realistic. There's no chance that we're not going to build more CO2-emitting devices going forward, and in fact, more are being built every day.
Qualitatively, what they seem to be saying was the current capital stock is not really where the climate problem lies.
Michael Grubb is a professor and senior research associate at Cambridge University and the editor-in-chief of the journal Climate Policy, and is not affiliated with this study.
The real problem will lie if there's a lot of new development and new investment and new capital stock. And in that sense, it is more of a future growth problem and future investment rather than, say, a need to drastically and prematurely retire existing capital stock.
Davis agrees, noting that while it's important to avoid a policy that creates an incentive to prolong the lifetime of existing CO2-emitting devices,
maybe one of the implications here is that we shouldn't waste political capital trying to decommission these things early, but rather focus on what's not been built and making sure that what is being built in the future is carbon-free or carbon-neutral.
That's easier said than done, however, since global energy demand is expected to soar in the coming decades, and that will require a lot of new energy infrastructure. To meet that projected demand without pushing warming well past the policy target of 2 degrees would mean that the world would need to come up with a huge amount of carbon-free energy in the next 40 years, which, suggests Davis, is a daunting task.
To reach zero emissions by 2050 and also meet the projected growth in demand, and especially in the developing world, we'd need to come up with something like 30 terawatts of carbon-free energy. And compare that to the fact that we're at less than 2 terawatts of carbon-free energy today, and you can really get a handle on the challenge that that is.
Moreover, says Michael Grubb, findings such as this one need to be interpreted carefully given the complex context of international economic growth, which in the future is likely to be increasingly focused in non-Western societies. That, he points out, could cause the study's results to be interpreted in 2 very different ways, depending on national and political values rather than the science.
One of which is, well, broadly, the problem in terms of future emissions is less to do with existing capital stock and is more to do with growth and new investment, and therefore it's a problem to do with Chinese development and Indian development and you know, where the major economic growth is occurring. And that's really where the action is required. That's where the major responsibility lies to address emissions. You can also, however, look at it in almost the opposite way and say capital stock is a representation of just how much the rich world has sunk into carbon emissions over the course of the 20th century. It's just an illustration of how much of the atmospheric space they have already tried to grab. This stuff can get very easily loaded. So there are some deeply contentious issues that could underlie the interpretation of this analysis.
Stephen Davis, while acknowledging these issues of global equity, suggests that the study's real implications lie in focusing policymakers on the magnitude and importance of the task ahead.
I'd like to think that people would see the result not as, okay, well, we're doing okay and that we just have to be more careful in the future, but rather really, like I said, framing the extent of the energy transition that we have ahead of us. And I think that it's fraught with issues of global equity, but it's a hugely important problem, and we're hoping that this can help to have people recognize that.
For Science, this is Sophia Kai.
You can read the paper by Stephen Davis and colleagues, Future CO2 Emissions and Climate Change from Existing Energy Infrastructure, as well as a related perspective article in this week's Science. In the year 2002, the Convention on Biological Diversity, an international treaty originally signed 10 years earlier, set a lofty goal: a significant slowdown in biodiversity loss by the year 2010. But now, in the middle of that year, it's become clear that the goal has not been met. Indeed, far from slowing, species loss continues to accelerate. Next month, the CBD will meet to adopt a new strategic plan for 2020. A special news focus in Science this week looks at progress and setbacks in a number of major areas of biodiversity conservation. I spoke with news writer Elizabeth Panisi, who edited the package and wrote one of its stories.
2010 is the International Year of Biodiversity. This year was targeted as a special year to recognize biodiversity because it's the year at which the Convention on Biological Diversity is taking stock of what it's done. The Convention on Biological Diversity was established in 1992. It's a treaty signed by 190 nations. As part of that treaty, the countries agreed that they would make biodiversity conservation a priority. And in about 2002, they set 2010 as their target to substantially reduce the rate of decline in biodiversity.
And in the story you've done for this package, you focus particularly on plant biodiversity and on the role of botanic gardens in protecting it. I actually love botanic gardens, but I guess I haven't tended to view them as sort of hotbeds of conservation activity.
Yes, many people don't think of botanic gardens as hotbeds of conservation activity, but actually they're the ones that have been safeguarding plants more than any other kind of organization.
Is that something new?
not new in the sense that they've been doing it for the last 10, 15 years. I mean, originally botanic gardens were set up to be places where you grew medicinal plants. And later they became places where plants collected from the rest of the world would be grown and shown to visitors. In the late 1990s, though, as people became more and more aware of the need for conservation, botanic gardens began taking on the role of safeguarding plants that were in trouble.
And I guess for that new role, that new sort of conservation role, what they've begun with is just an effort to list what plant species are actually out there. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So what the Botanic Gardens did in the early 2000s was come up with a global strategy for plant conservation. And they realized that the first thing they needed to do was come up with a list of all the plants, which is something that hasn't been done. Instead, what you have is a problem where, say, a scientist in one country will describe a plant and a scientist in another country will describe the same plant but name it a different species. And so you have millions of species names, but not all of them are unique species.
So part of it is just kind of deduping the list, if
that's
you
right.
will.
That's right.
And that sounds like a pretty daunting task. What sort of techniques have they been using to do this?
Well, originally what botanists were doing is they'd go through the literature and compare by hand all the different plant names and try and figure out when the plant names were really synonyms. But it turned out that that was taking way too much time. So what the Missouri Botanical Garden and the Royal Botanic Garden in Kew did was come up with a way to get computers to sort out what's the original name and what's the synonym name.
So they now have this sort of computer-assisted list of sort of most of the plants, or how far has that gotten?
It's gotten much farther along than it would have been by hand, but they still got a ways to go. Estimates range from like 370,000 to 400-some-thousand plants in the world, and they probably have about half to two-thirds of them now sorted out.
And I guess the next step after listing them is determining which ones are actually endangered?
That's right.
So obviously making these lists and sorting out names is important, and it sounds like an impressive achievement, even if it's not, you know, quite finished. But it seems to be going so slowly, and the pace of species loss seems so rapid. What are these organizations doing to actually, you know, save threatened plant species on the ground, if you will?
Well, one of the goals set by this global strategy for plant conservation was to have what's called ex situ conservation. That's when you bring a plant in from the wild and you grow it in your botanical garden. So the goal was to have by 2010, 60% of endangered plants to be conserved outside of their natural habitats. So that would mean 60% of endangered plants being grown in botanical gardens. And then they also wanted to have 10% of those plants in recovery programs where they would be reintroduced to their natural environments once they've been cultivated.
And how is that effort going?
It's hard to judge because they don't really know how many plants are endangered. But the rough estimates were that by 2007, 35% of endangered plants were in ex situ cultivation and 5% were in recovery programs.
Well, that sounds encouraging. I mean, clearly a lot of hard work going on here. Just sort of generally, how would you characterize how successful all of these efforts have been? Or how is the plant community looking at it?
Well, the plant community is very proud of what it's been able to accomplish in the last 10 years. And one reason they can be so proud is they have seen progress in many of their goals for the strategic plan that they set out to achieve by 2010. The Convention on Biological Diversity has not achieved its major goal, which was to reduce the rate of biodiversity loss. Instead, the rate of biodiversity loss has increased. So in comparison, the plant people feel like they've been doing pretty good.
But more generally, I guess it sounds like biodiversity is still in trouble. So what's the outlook for plant biodiversity conservation in the future?
I think it depends on how the funding goes. Plants haven't attracted the popular interest that, say, polar bears have, even though they're very important. And while the botanical gardens think that they've done a good job so far, many of them feel like more money is needed, more resources are needed for them to really succeed in their goals.
Liz Panisi, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Elizabeth Panisi edits a special news package in this week's Science on the state of global biodiversity in 2010. Also in the issue, you'll find a review article by Mike Rands and colleagues on the challenges for biodiversity conservation beyond 2010. The pathology of Alzheimer's disease involves two proteins, amyloid beta and tau, which seem to work together to gum up the brain and impair cognitive functions. And while it's been shown in mouse models that lowering levels of the tau protein can help prevent Alzheimer-like defects, it's been unclear just why. A new paper published online by Science suggests an answer. High amyloid beta levels impair the transport of important cellular cargoes along neuronal axons, but can only do so when tau is present. So reduction in tau helps prevent those amyloid beta-induced traffic jams and keep the axonal transport system flowing freely. The work could renew interest in tau reduction as a possible Alzheimer's therapeutic direction. I spoke with the lead author of the paper, Keith Vossel, from his office at UCSF.
To find a cure for Alzheimer's disease, scientists are searching for what are the earliest events that trigger the demise of neurons. And, you know, my study was regarding axonal transport.
And when you say axonal transport, you're referring to the transport of cargoes along neuronal axons, the sort of long prominences that come off of the ends of neurons.
Exactly. So a neuron has a cell body. It has these shorter processes called dendrites, which communicate with other neurons that are nearby. And then it has a long process called an axon, which communicates with neurons further away. And so these axons are very long structures and often several thousand times the size of the cell body itself. And so axonal transport is really important to get cargoes where they need to be from the points where they are made. Oftentimes, things like mitochondria or even synaptic proteins are made near the cell body, and then they need to be transported to vital regions within the cell.
And so how does all of this tie into Alzheimer's?
So in Alzheimer's disease, there are really two main pathogenic factors that we are studying. And these are amyloid beta, which is a peptide, which is derived from the amyloid precursor protein, and the microtubule-associated protein tau. Amyloid beta and tau can form what are called plaques and tangles, which are the neuropathological hallmarks of the disease. And we previously showed in our lab that reducing tau levels is protective in mouse models of Alzheimer's disease. Even though the brains of tau-deficient mice were completely riddled with these amyloid plaques, the tau reduction was protective against amyloid beta-induced memory deficits and other abnormalities. We were curious whether this might be caused, at least in part, by improvements in axonal transport. Amyloid beta brings axonal traffic to a state of gridlock in diseased neurons. These traffic jams cause a redistribution of vital cargoes, such as mitochondria, which are the energy-producing organelles, and TrkA, a receptor for nerve growth factor. Because tau reduction protects neurons against the toxic effects of amyloid beta, and tau is concentrated in the axon, we were curious whether amyloid beta requires tau to impair axonal transport. What we know about tau is that it provides support for microtubules, which are the tracks for axonal transport, but whether tau itself regulates axonal transport is controversial.
Okay, so you were trying to look at why lowering the levels of the tau protein sort of seemed to prevent some of the abnormalities associated with Alzheimer's. Is that correct?
That's correct. So in this study, we investigated the effects of both amyloid beta and tau on axonal transport.
Well, it must be quite a trick to look at how these proteins are being transported and tease out, you know, the effects of these things. How did you go about doing it?
Well, yes, you're correct. Until recently, it was really difficult to get an idea of these molecular events that are occurring. Now we have techniques where we can actually view fluorescently labeled proteins and organelles in neurons under the microscope within an incubation chamber so that they are actually under sort of physiologic conditions. And we can see through live imaging what is occurring in the cell over time. So we can actually track the movement of these different cellular components using time-lapse imaging under a fluorescent microscope.
And you use that to look at the effect of tau reduction in some sort of mouse model, is that right?
Correct. So these neurons were derived from mice that were genetically made so that they have tau either present or completely deleted or partially reduced. The first question was whether reducing tau in and of itself has an effect on axonal transport. And this was a controversial topic before now, and I think still deserves more investigation. But what we found was that reducing tau in and of itself had no effect on transport of mitochondria and this TrkA receptor that we were looking at. And this is consistent with more recent studies that look at the optic pathway and looking at axonal transport of different structural proteins. Now we're looking more at a disease region called the hippocampus, which is a really core affected region in Alzheimer's disease that subserves memory formation. And so what we're seeing in these hippocampal neurons is that reducing tau really didn't have much of an effect on the physiologic transport of these cargos, but when you add amyloid beta, there's a dramatic reduction in the transport of both cargos, especially in the anterograde direction, which is away from the cell body towards the synapse.
And so when these amyloid beta peptides were present and presumably impairing axonal transport in the way that you say, that's when you saw this beneficial effect from reducing tau?
That is correct. So what we were proposing is that tau does regulate axonal transport, but primarily under pathophysiologic conditions. And there are a number of possible explanations for this. We know that tau, in and of itself, can form a barrier to the attachment of motor proteins to the microtubules from single molecule studies. But whether this is important under physiologic conditions in the mammalian cells is still up for debate. And I think our study provides some clarity to the current understanding of how tau regulates transport by showing that tau can have an effect on transport, primarily under conditions of the disease state.
This was an in vitro study. This was not done in actual animals and certainly not in humans. What are some of the complications of interpreting this in a more in vivo setting?
Mm-hmm. So in vivo studies are needed to validate whether this occurs in diseased regions of the brain. And current in vivo techniques are not really ready to address this question in the hippocampus. We are looking at tracking the axonal transport of mitochondria in the cortex using a technique called transcranial confocal microscopy, and we are just developing this technology now. But there are, I think, a lot of centers that are poised to address this question, and it is an important question. It's sort of, I think, the most important next step in determining the importance of these results for the human condition.
What do you suppose this means for Alzheimer's therapies and for promising sort of therapeutic directions in the future?
Well, we're excited about these findings because to date, the therapies that have targeted the amyloid beta plaques have really not yielded any effective treatments. And we feel that targeting tau may be an alternative and complementary treatment to amyloid reduction, because tau is a protein that seems to enable a beta to exert its toxic effects on the brain. So removing tau, at least in mouse models, is quite protective in terms of memory and other behavioral abnormalities.
So is anything actually being done out there to investigate therapies with tau reduction now?
Yes, I think tau reduction therapies or tau targeted therapies have lagged a little behind the amyloid therapies, but there are a number of treatments that are under development or even in phase 2 and 3 trials now that target the tau protein to prevent it from aggregating into these neurofibrillary tangles, which then in and of themselves may be toxic to neurons. Tau reduction strategies are even further behind, and we are one of several groups that are looking into ways of reducing tau either through RNA interference, different compounds that may reduce this tau protein or tau RNA. We do realize that tau may have an important physiologic role in neurons, and whether humans can tolerate complete tau reduction is unknown. Therefore, we think that partial tau reduction, which is also protective against axonal transport defects and was protective in our mouse models of Alzheimer's disease, may strike a balance between therapeutic safety and efficacy.
Keith Vossel, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure, thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you today.
Keith Vossel is the lead author of a new study on a possible mechanism for the protective effects of tau reduction in Alzheimer's disease. You can find the paper at www.scienceexpress.org. Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor for Science, is here with a few notable stories from our daily news site. Well, first, David, a new proposal to stem global warming?
Right, Stuart. This all involves a burgeoning field called geoengineering, and these are basically sometimes fairly wacky schemes for trying to cool the planet. Scientists have proposed everything from launching volcanic gas and dust, essentially, into the atmosphere to block sunlight, to filling the ocean with billions of tiny bubbles to reflect sunlight, or even seeding the ocean with iron that would grow a lot of marine organisms that would consume carbon dioxide. All schemes to try to either reduce CO2 levels or greenhouse gas levels, or somehow block the sunlight so the Earth doesn't warm as fast as it is currently.
So kind of extreme measures.
Exactly. And this latest measure fits very well with all these other measures. It's essentially using tiny flying saucers to block sunlight. These tiny flying saucers, they're actually about 20 nanometers wide, so they're incredibly tiny. They operate by a phenomenon known as photoparesis. And basically what this phenomenon is if you take a material and one side of it, the top side, is made of a different material than the other and would heat faster or slower than the other, what happens is that gas can actually build up beneath the material and actually lift it. And so what this scientist proposes is he proposed creating these 20 nanometer wide discs, essentially, and their top is made out of aluminum. Their bottoms are made out of a compound known as barium titanate. And what happens is, if you were to, say, throw this object in the air or place it on the ground, the heat differential between the top and the bottom of the object would cause the air to essentially lift these objects into the air. In fact, the scientist calculates that these objects would be lifted about 40 to 50 kilometers in the air.
So you've got a bunch of tiny sort of suspended mirrors up
there? Exactly. You've got a bunch of tiny suspended mirrors way up there in the stratosphere. And what they're doing up there is they're reflecting sunlight, and theoretically, by reflecting all that sunlight, less sun's hitting the Earth, and the Earth would start cooling, or maybe at least not warm as fast as it would otherwise.
Well, you know, I guess the trouble I have with a lot of these geoengineering schemes is kind of the law of unintended consequences. You know, I mean, could the cure be worse than the disease here?
Exactly. And that's one of the big problems with geoengineering, whether you're talking about throwing a lot of iron into the ocean, which people say could disrupt ecosystems, or what I talked about earlier in terms of putting sulfur dioxide and other components of volcanic gases into the atmosphere, that could actually destroy the ozone layer. So as you said, the cure could be worse with the disease. And the same could be true of these tiny flying saucers. The researcher who envisioned them admits that anything that affects sunlight could also affect rainfall patterns. So even though you might help cool the Earth, you might get these really wacky and sometimes disastrous weather patterns that could wreak just as much havoc as global warming does. So he's not proposing we throw all these things in the atmosphere right now. He's saying a lot more study is done. And he's actually saying, I wish we didn't have to do this at all. I wish humans were just better about controlling greenhouse gas emissions. We wouldn't even have to think about all these wacky schemes. But he's saying, if worse comes to worse, this may be a potential option.
Well, okay, getting back down to Earth, the next story, I guess, is about premature babies. Tell me about that one.
Well, Stuart, when babies are born prematurely in the hospital, doctors face a really big dilemma. Some premature babies end up just fine, even though they're born really early. Maybe they have a few minor problems in the hospital, but after a few weeks, they're doing just fine. And some premature babies don't do well at all. In fact, sometimes they can die, and if they don't die, sometimes they develop serious health issues like organ failure or respiratory failure, some big problems. The problem is that it's really hard to tell in those first few hours of life which premature babies are going to have bad outcomes and which ones are going to have good outcomes.
So when my own children were born, there was something called the Apgar test. Is that no longer done? Or?
No, actually, that is still the standard. This Apgar test basically takes a few fairly common measurements, like how well a baby's moving and breathing, and even the baby's skin tone, if the baby is pale or blue, or if it's nice and healthy and pink. And it compiles all these into what's called an Apgar score, and physicians use that to try to determine how that baby's going to do. But the problem is the Apgar score is not very accurate. In fact, when it comes to predicting very serious outcomes of prematurity, it's only about 70% effective. And obviously, you want to try something that's a lot better than that. The other problem with the Apgar is there's a lot of manual work that goes into that, you know, looking at skin tone and writing down figures for that and breathing and stuff like that. And so in this new study, researchers wanted to try to develop something that was much easier, much more automatic, and ideally much more accurate than the Apgar score.
And so what did they do?
What they did was they looked at over 100 infants in a particular hospital, and these were all premature babies, and they classified these infants into two groups, the ones that they considered high risk. These are the infants that went on to develop much more serious disorders after they were born, and low risk. These were the infants that did pretty well, even though they were born prematurely. And then the researchers went back and looked at a lot of measurements that are taken automatically when a baby is born, things like how much oxygen is in the baby's blood and its respiratory rate and its heart rate. So things that this data is automatically being collected anyways in the first three hours of life. And the researchers fed all this data into a formula, and they said, is there anything about this data that correlates very well to how these babies do? And indeed, after they did some messing around with some mathematical algorithms, they came up with something they called the FISA score. And this is a score which ranges from 0 to 1. And the higher premature baby rates on that score, the more likely it is to develop a serious problem after it's born. So, for example, an infant with a score of 0.8 would have about an 80% chance of developing serious complications.
So they basically worked backward from what the outcomes were and kind of modeled the best fit, if you will, of all of the factors that led to that.
Exactly.
So how well does this FISA score actually predict things?
Well, as I said before, the APGAR's accuracy is anywhere from about 70 to 74%. And there's some more invasive tests, like taking blood from the infants, that have a range of about 82 to 90%. But the researchers found that this FISA score, it was as good as 98% accurate in predicting outcomes for these premature babies. So not only was it much more accurate than the APGAR score, but it's a lot more accurate than these other tests that are very invasive. And the great thing about FISA score, the researchers say, is that it's not invasive at all. We're just taking data that's automatically collected from these babies, throwing them into a formula, and it spits out a number that can really help doctors decide, you know, a lot of these hospitals have very limited resources. And so if they're confronted with a lot of premature babies, they really need to know which are the ones that we really need to put attention on and which are the ones that they don't. And so the hope is with a score like that that's really accurate, physicians can allocate their resources accurately so that they're really treating these children that are the most at risk before they develop serious complications.
Well, that sounds quite compelling. And finally, in the news you can use department, some research on how guys can impress women on the dance floor.
That's right, Stuart. This last story is about the precise dance moves that a guy can make, or rock, as we say in the article, that will really impress a woman. The reason researchers study this, they weren't just trying to get a bunch of guys to dance and have a lot of fun in the laboratory. There's actually evidence in the animal kingdom, besides humans, that animals use various motions, especially the male animals use various motions to impress females. For example, male fiddler crabs have this really big claw that they sort of wave around and supposed to impress females. And male hummingbirds have this flamboyant mating dive that they do that is supposed to impress a female with their aeronautical skills. And the research said, you know, when guys dance, is it possible that they're not only just having a good time, but maybe unconsciously they're sending out some signals about how evolutionarily fit they are? In other words, how good of a mate they are because maybe they're well coordinated or strong or whatever.
Well, dancing certainly seems like something that would be hard to get a precise handle on. How did they actually study this?
Well, that's a good point, because if you just brought a bunch of guys into a room and had them dance in front of women, there's a lot of confounding factors. The main one being, if you're going to ask a woman if she's turned on by a guy's dance, the first thing that she's going to look at is how attractive the guy is. And the guy may be a great dancer, but if he's not very good looking, the woman may say, well, he's not a very good dancer, or I don't like him. So the researchers really wanted to eliminate that. And so what they did was they took a cue from James Cameron and Peter Jackson, and they recruited about 30 guys, and they put a bunch of reflective markers on various parts of their body. And they did something called motion capture technology. And this is something that's often used in the movies to create, you know, King Kong or Gollum in Lord of the Rings. And what they did was they created these computer avatars of these guys. They had these guys dance for about 30 seconds to what they call a thumping drum beat. And then they showed these avatar videos to the women, and they said, which guy do you think is the best dancer? And the researchers had done a previous study where they showed that when the woman said he's a good dancer, what she really meant is I'm attracted to him. So this was a proxy for how attractive a guy was based on his dancing.
So don't keep us in suspense, David. I mean, what moves were the ones that worked?
We've got two videos on the site that you can check out. One is of a bad dancer and one is of
That's my group.
And one is a good dancer. And you'll see a very dramatic difference between the two. But boiled down, essentially what good dancers do is they tend to move their head and torso a lot, and they don't flail their arms and legs a lot. It turns out the secret to good dancing is really more sort of in the upper body and not having very much to do with the limbs. Whereas the guys that were bad dancers tended to sort of trudge around in a circle or make these awkward movements. These are all things that sound fairly obvious, but when you see the video, it really comes out at you. It's very striking, really what separates a good dancer from a bad dancer.
Well, clearly this seems to matter to women, but why, actually?
Well, so researchers are wondering if it all traces back to what we see in fiddler crabs and hummingbirds. Are these signals somehow an indicator of how fit a man is? Maybe there is some sort of indicator of his strength or health. And so the research say in the next day what they want to do is figure out, okay, let's take all the dancers that the women found attractive or that they thought that were good dancers, and let's try to find out if these men are somehow healthier or stronger or in any other way more desirable from an evolutionary standpoint than the men that were bad dancers. So we'll have to wait and see a little bit for that research.
Okay, well, Dave, what other stories are you looking into on the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about the first hunchback dinosaur and also a story about how flying fish fly. And on Science Insider, Science's policy site, we've got a story about the International Year of Astronomy, what's going on with that. And also, we're continuing our coverage of the stem cell issue in the United States. A couple weeks ago, a federal judge basically barred researchers from using government money in the U.S. to fund human embryonic stem cell research. And there's been a lot of new developments. We're following this on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times a day. So be sure to check out the site for updates on that and for all of these stories.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the September 10th, 2010 edition of the Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her contribution to this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.